From the future of JEA to tensions between city council and the mayor's office, there's lots happening at City Hall. This hour, Council President Anna Brochet gives her take. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, Jacksonville City Council President Anna Lopez Brochet steps into Studio 5. She's talking about what's going on at City Hall, and she's taking your calls. We're already getting your calls. You can get on the line right now at 549-2937. Then later, a look at the bipartisan move to preserve America's national parks, including those 11 national park units right here in Florida. Plus, it's a threat this summer to your health. Some tips for protecting yourself against Lyme disease, along with new research on how the disease is spread. All of that ahead this morning. But first, this hour, she's been in the forefront in the contentious debate over whether the city of Jacksonville should sell off JEA. Council President Anna Brochet has provided a check and balance on this issue against the Curry administration, and it sometimes turned into a very public dispute. With the privatization of JEA, though, now off the table and an interim CEO installed at the utility, there's still a lot to discuss around this issue and the city of Jacksonville as a whole. Jacksonville City Council President Anna Brochet joins us now in studio to talk about these issues and more and take your calls. President Brochet, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Already getting lots of calls for Anna Brochet, president of the Jacksonville City Council. What are your questions for her? Get on the line now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and we welcome your comments as well on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Lots of those, as there always tends to be around this issue. All right, Council President Anna Brochet, lots to get into, but let's begin with the issue that's been dominating the local headlines for months, even though it has mostly been resolved. The issue of privatizing JEA seems to be off the table for now. There's an interim CEO installed, Aaron Zahn. That process, too, was controversial. I know that people ask you about this a lot, but could you begin by sharing your thoughts with us about how this process played out and how you see it going forward?
Well, it has been a very botched process from the very beginning. In order to make it so far down the road with a simple statement by an outgoing board chair that privatization should be considered, and to launch as much as has been launched, it just seemed really fast and way out of order. So,
what was out of order?
Well, in order for that to happen, we should privatize. Then, for the board chair to launch and hire a consultant to study the value without any discussion at the board level, to spend $100,000 to do that, and then to call a meeting of the council before we had heard from our attorney, before we had heard from our council auditor regarding the questions that had been asked. So the council hadn't even really had its advice yet, and we needed to hear that presentation when we did. So it just, you know, and then we learned later that it wasn't Mr. McElroy who called that meeting.
The former CEO of JEA.
He didn't call that meeting. He was instructed by the mayor's office to ask me for that meeting, which I did not want to have.
And so it sounds as though you are buying into a narrative which took hold around this whole debate that there was a lack of transparency about who was behind this idea and how it was going to be executed.
Absolutely. It's not adding up.
And who do you hold accountable for that?
You know, I've asked that question of the new interim CEO. That was one of the questions we talked about in our private meeting, is who's responsible for, you know, launching the consultant and also issuing that golden parachute letter to key executives at JEA about, you know, having incentive retention pay to stay on in the event of a potential sale. And he, without, you know, wanting to disrespect the former CEO, said that he felt that it was the CEO's responsibility. I'm, you know, who's involved where, it's all a big question to me. But at the end of the day, we're taking the opportunity to understand the facts, to have discussions and ask people questions as a part of this whole process, and evaluating the fact that we as a council should understand more about JEA. Clearly, there's a lot of question, and we should make sure that we're understanding what the future of JEA is.
As the current council president, you have exercised a check and balance power on the other side of City Hall, the mayor's office. It's been no secret that you've had a tense relationship with Mayor Curry. Critics of that dynamic have criticized both you and the mayor for not working together more collegially. How do you respond to that criticism?
So I'll never part with the fundamental belief that it takes two to tango, and that relationship relationships are made up of what each person contributes to it. And the reality is, you're right, Melissa, there is a trust issue. And
on both sides?
On both sides. Absolutely. And so from my perspective, you know, when I am instructed that I'm not allowed to have any meetings with department heads or ask staff any questions without clearing things through the mayor's office, it's like, why are you blocking me? I'm a council member, and all 19 of us are trying to serve the city just like the mayor is. And when I have meetings with people in the community and hear from them later on that they have been contacted by the mayor's office, you know, at least to let them know that they knew that they met with me, you know, and then when I learn that my assistant's computer is being monitored, you know, so
who's monitoring your assistant's
computer?
I really don't know.
She was trying to log off, and it said you can't log off because someone else is on this machine.
So is it your contention that you and your staff are being spied on?
I find it difficult to not reach that conclusion, but I'm just putting together my experiences and observations of things that happen on a regular basis.
Do you feel that there is an element of harassment to what's your experience has been in this position?
You know, someone may take it there. I believe everything happens how and when it should, and I'm doing the best I can to make a difference and just to proceed. I don't really watch my back. I do what I need to do and move forward.
There will be a new city council president in a few months.
Yes, May 22nd is the vote.
Okay. So what are your thoughts about how the new city council will handle relations with the mayor's office?
You know,
and what are your political plans?
Sure. We're all different people. There's a different culture, a different dynamic, because I think the beauty, and I said this when I started my term and I started serving on council, is that the beauty of the council is that we all have different ideas and perspectives. And I think great policy happens when people are able to exercise their ideas and to express them. We've had a challenge with that in terms of, you know, some of the, you know, bullying and intimidation that happens. And so at the end of the day, it's up to whoever becomes president. It looks very much Council Vice President Bowman has the pledges to secure that, and it's up to him how he wants to manage that relationship. And so
you just use the words bullying and intimidation. Who do you attribute? Who are you accusing the mayor's office of bullying and intimidation?
Yes, I mean, I think I've described a couple of items already that you could, you know, characterize as such. And so.
So what are your thoughts about you, Anna Broche, in terms of your political future? I know that you have gotten a lot of feedback about this process as it's played out. You've got a lot of fans out there. You've got some detractors out there.
Yes.
Are you planning to run for re-election on the city council, or do you have other plans?
So, number one, I'm really flattered by all of that feedback that I am receiving in terms of encouraging me to consider an opportunity to run for mayor. The reality is that I'm in a sprint to the finish of my council presidency, which ends on June 30th. I have launched a number of really important initiatives, and I want to make sure that I'm very present and making sure that they end successfully. And, you know, after the conclusion of my presidency, I have a lot to think about, and there'll be some clarity in terms of what my next steps will be.
That sounds as though you're contemplating a run for mayor.
You know, I'm going to keep all my options open.
So it's an option. It's a possibility.
We'll be thinking a lot after the end of the presidency.
Let's go to some calls now for City Council President Anna Brochet, 549-2937. Jack on the South Side. Hi, Jack. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you today?
Great, thanks.
So my question is, what role, President Brochet, do you believe Tom Petway has played in the JA discussion, and what motivated it?
Okay, and that, thank you for that. And that was the retiring JEA board member who, as he stepped off the board, teed up the idea of, let's discuss privatizing JEA.
Well, he kicked it off on November 28th as he was exiting his final board meeting, had encouraged the board members who were remaining to consider whether or not Jacksonville would be better served by privatizing those services. So ultimately, the role is pretty big when it appears as if that's the beginning of this entire process. So he kicked it off, and everybody really appreciated that question because it launched, you know, the hiring of a consultant, the drafting of a letter, and the potential issuing of a letter to key executives about, you know, incentive retention pay in case there was a transaction or was a change of ownership. And then, you know, the presentation to the City Council of that consultant report with an estimated value. So it launched a lot.
Do you think that there was coordination behind the scenes before that was publicly tossed out?
I really don't know for certain. What I do know is that the coordination from the mayor's office about the meeting on February 14th to hear the presentation of the consultant, and then learning later through some news reports that there had been a number of meetings between the mayor's office and the JEA staff regarding that particular meeting.
549-2937. Jim is in Riverside. Hi, Jim. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. And I want to thank the council president for her leadership this year. We've certainly needed someone to stand strong on our behalf in this process. And I want to ask the council president, now that the mayor has publicly declared that he won't pursue the sale of JEA, does the council intend to proceed on some of the bills that are still in the hopper regarding this, particularly the two Schellenberg bills about giving up the money and from any proceeds, and the bill about encouraging the mayor to proceed with a evaluation? Those are two that are still in committee. I just want to know if the council intends to proceed on those.
Well, thank you for that question, Jim. The president doesn't really determine whether or not legislation goes away. Each of these bills has their own sponsor. And it's my understanding from reading some news reports that Councilman Schellenberg has indicated he has every intention to proceed with the consideration of the legislation that he's introduced. So I'm sure that we would consider it all. At any point, any council member can choose to withdraw their legislation and have us not take it up. So in my mind, we're going to proceed until that happens.
549-2937, as we speak with Jacksonville City Council President Anna Brochet. Susan is down in Mandarin right now. Hey, Susan, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have Rule 1.106 says the president of the city council can appoint a chaplain, and City Council President Anna Brochet appointed Dole Carter. Carter has invited mostly Baptists to give the invocation, and I was wondering if City Council President Anna Brochet knows how Carter is selecting those invocation speakers. I know a humanist applied in January, and he has not been put on the schedule. And I realize that Carter can pray any way he likes according to his own States, but once he starts calling people to the podium to speak out loud at a government meeting, he cannot discriminate based on many court rulings, especially the most recently, Grace v. Galloway. So I was wondering, what is Carter's policy in selecting invocation speakers, and does the city council president support that policy? And if she doesn't support that policy, why is she allowing him to continue to be chaplain? And has she ever considered outsourcing the job of choosing invocation speakers to an interfaith group like One Jacks, perhaps?
Okay, thanks for that question. And, you know, other city council presidents have dealt with this issue over the years. Former council president Jack Webb was on this program years ago and talked about this issue, whether to have a sectarian prayer, an inclusive prayer, no invocation at all. This is an issue local government bodies are dealing with all over the country. What about this controversy, this issue in Jacksonville?
Well, Susan, thank you for that question. And I have received and all of Susan's emails on this particular topic, seeking to understand what Councilman Carter's policy is. I do not know what his policy is, and so I also understand that she has incorporated reaching out to the Office of General Counsel in the process of trying to understand what that is. And ultimately, I did appoint Doyle Carter chaplain. It's a position that he requested. I surveyed all of my colleagues in terms of how they wanted to serve the council and the city and our colleagues. And I've put that responsibility in his hands. And this is where we are in terms of we've got a long list of how he's invited folks to serve.
Tom on the west side. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes. Well, first, let me say thank you for your position and support in opposition to this JA thing. I really do encourage you to run for mayor. I think it's time for a change of leadership. But my concern here and my question is this. With so much of this discussion about JA and all the process taking place behind the scenes, Mayor Curry's decision to no longer publicly follow up on this leaves me with the question, is this is going to be pursued back channel? What is your opinion on that?
Well, in terms of how things have played out since that declaration and everyone questioning, I'm getting lots of questions on how the board selected the interim CEO, Aaron Zahn, and what vetting took place and really something else that doesn't add up. And so I am going to, based on my experiences of how this process has played out and how I was requested to move forward in considering legislation to approve next steps prior to that particular meeting that we had to hear from the consultant, just a lot of different things have come up and been revealed after the fact. It has not been a transparent process. And mm-hmm. and because other parts of it also appear to lack transparency, I'm just going to be inquisitive and I'm going to ask questions. And that's just what my career is.
You mean in terms of your career in the private sector as well?
Yeah.
As a business owner, accountant?
Yeah. So I'm an auditor.
Auditor.
So from day one of my professional career, I have been trained to ask questions, to understand the why behind everything, and to make sure that things add up. That's why the people elected me. And that's exactly what I'm going to do.
Lots of email, tweets, Facebook comments coming in from listeners and voters out there. Here's Jennifer in Jacksonville. She emails the show. I just want to thank Ms. Brochet for her courage in standing up to Mayor Curry, taking a strong stand in favor of transparency in our city government. Shauna tweets the show, please thank the councilwoman for stopping the backdoor dealing that was behind the JEA privatization push. Here is a tweet for you from Florida politics writer A.G. Gankarski. He writes, it's interesting. Hang on a second. Let me call it up. I'm trying to race through these. Interesting to hear Anna Brochet not shooting down a potential mayoral run. It feels like an evolution in her position. My question, has she been encouraged to run by the people who can donate to her campaign and keep pace with Lenny Curry? Of course, Mayor Curry has already amassed a sizable campaign war chest and is running for re-election. The conventional wisdom has been that nobody would take him on for that reason more than any other, because it's so expensive to run for a citywide office like that. Are big donors going to support you if you decide to throw your hat in the ring?
So at the end of the day, I think I shared earlier that the consideration of moving forward and what my options are going forward is something that I look forward to spending a lot of time with after the completion of my presidency. You know, it'd be a disservice on my part to not hear the outcry, which I shared earlier. I'm grateful and appreciate. I'm flattered by all of the folks who are asking me to consider, and I need to think about that.
Do you think you could put together enough money to make a credible run at it? Also, you're a Republican. No Democrats of note. I think there are someone filed, but there's no one on the Democratic side who would look to have the name recognition and the fundraising to make a credible run at that office. Do you think you could attract the financial and civic support that you would need to take on a sitting incumbent Republican mayor as a fellow Republican?
These are all of the questions that I really need to spend time with, Melissa. And I think you know that my service and my presidency has not demonstrated a lack of courage. And so these are things I'll be thinking about.
Well, you certainly made some news this morning. So thank you for joining us and sharing your thoughts with us on the air. We appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
Jacksonville City Council President Anna Brochet not ruling out a run for mayor of Jacksonville. You heard it here first, and much more still ahead later. Lyme disease is a growing problem across the country, particularly in the summer months. We're going to share with you some tips to protect yourself and some new research. But up next, a bipartisan move to preserve our national parks. That's in a moment.
The Florida Theater presents Ira Glass, creator and host of This American Life, live at the Florida Theater Saturday, November 10th, 8 p.m. Using audio clips, music, and video, Ira Glass delivers a unique talk sharing lessons from his life and career in storytelling. Ira Glass, live at Florida Theater. Tickets, floridatheater.com.
Nemours is not simply a place for care. Nemours is a way of caring for children. Our promise to treat each child as if they were our own means we'll do whatever is in our power to improve the health of children, regardless of ability to pay. You can help. Visit nemours.org/ourpromise.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app, Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
Join WJCT for Be My Neighbor Day, Saturday, May 5th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the WJCT studios. The day will include family-friendly activities, PBS Kids characters, food trucks, and so much more. The event is free, but reservations are required. For more information, log on to wjct.org/events.
Welcome back. Well, it's a bipartisan effort to preserve and restore our nation's precious national parks. It turns out America has been kicking the can down the road when it comes to upkeep in our national parks. The Pew Charitable Trusts has new data on their Restore America's Parks initiative. They've been looking at this, and the total cost of these projects, which have been deferred for at least a year due to lack of congressional funding, well, it stands at $11.6 billion nationwide. $262 million in Florida is needed to restore our 11 national park units around the state. Here with more about this, we welcome John Adornato. He's with the National Parks Conservation Association. He's on the line. Hi, John.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. And joining us in studio, Mark Woods, columnist with the Florida Times Union and author of Lassoing the Sun, A Year in America's National Parks. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
All right, let's start with you, John Adornato. Pew is working to restore America's national parks and raise awareness about this $11.6 billion deferred maintenance backlog facing the National Park Service. That's a pretty big backlog, John, and I would think it would be a challenge to get Congress to fund this, given all of the competing priorities that they're facing. Can you begin by sharing with us the scope of the problem and what this deferred maintenance looks like in some of our more well-known national parks?
I sure can. Well, you mentioned some of these projects have been delayed for over a year. Some have been delayed for over a decade or more in some cases. These are problems that affect the average visitor's experience at our national parks, as well as how the Park Service can maintain and ensure that the natural and cultural resources are actually protected. And national parks celebrate and commemorate our most treasured landscapes and our shared historic and cultural American history. Sometimes even the places that tell our painful past, like right here at Timaquan Ecological and Historic Preserve. But what we're really trying to do is to educate the American public, and particularly our members of Congress, that this is a problem that can be tackled. And we are so pleased to see that this is indeed a bipartisan effort in Washington to work together to provide this dedicated funding to fix this problem. And so we're pleased that Congressman Rutherford has joined on as a co-sponsor to one of the bills going around in Congress, Senator Nelson, and a total of 10 members of Congress in Florida are supporting this effort.
That's right. This Friday, in fact, representatives from Pew and the National Parks Conservation Association will be touring our own Timaquan Ecological and Historic Preserve right here in Jacksonville, our own national park here, along with Congressman Rutherford to promote the Restore America's Parks Initiative. Mark Woods, you, of course, are well known for your affiliation with our national parks. You're the author of the book Lassoing the Sun, A Year in America's National Parks. You've spent a lot of time in the park, so I think you have a special appreciation for why this is something that, as a country, we should be focusing on.
Right, and these are the kind of things that always have, you know, historically been bipartisan. You know, clean water, clean air, our national parks. I mean, I think it was when I was working on this project in 2012, MPCA, I believe, had done a poll at that point asking Americans about their support of the national parks. And they phrased, I forget exactly how they phrased it, but it was basically 90% of Americans supported.
Yeah.
And, you know, what can we get 90% of America to agree upon? There's not many things these days.
That's right.
But the national parks are one of them. So, and yet here we're cutting, you know, lately we've been, the proposals have been to cut budgets, cut regulation, cut the things that protect and save these places. So this would be, you know, John knows the details much better than I do, but this would be finally a little step forward in a time when we've taken a lot of step backward.
Let's talk, John, about the National Park Service Legacy Act. As you pointed out, it has strong bipartisan support in both houses of Congress, and it lays out a 30-year plan to pay down this maintenance backlog all around the country in our national parks, Grand Canyon, Redwood, our own Timaquan Preserve, Yellowstone, all the beloved places, special places in our country. How would this plan work?
Well, you know, I think what's important, something that Mark said, is National Parks Conservation Association has been working for a long time to make sure that that Americans have a voice for their national parks. And that is exactly what NPCA does, is provide a voice for our national parks. So we've been speaking about the regular operations and maintenance budget of the National Park Service and how it's on an annual basis underfunded. These are America's favorite places. This is America's backyard, places where we love and learn and get educated about our culture and our history, as well as our natural resources. And the deferred maintenance is one component of that long funding challenge. It has been, as I indicated before, a decades-long problem that we're so pleased is finally being discussed on Capitol Hill. And so what we want to see and what we want all of your listeners to do is call up your member of Congress and say, help us tackle this problem. And for those folks who are, you know, champions and helping lead this train, to thank them for it. Because what this bill and what other what we want to see happen is we want a dedicated funding stream for tackling this problem, because the annual operation and maintenance fund is just not enough to overcome this $11 billion problem. When the Park Service gets $300 million a year in maintenance costs, it would take us far too long to tackle it. So what we need is a dedicated funding source. This proposal tackles the very income of the federal federal government, and we can utilize those funds from the offshore oil royalties that the federal government collects.
So an annual resource for park infrastructure just financed using oil and gas revenues. Mark Woods, that seems like a pretty elegant solution, I guess, to this, if it can pass political muster.
Right. It seems like it's an easy way. We're not saying we're raising these taxes or that. And as John said, this is nothing new. This backlog, when I had that year that I spent, I think it was over $10 billion at that point. So the needle has been high like this for a long time. And I met with MPCA folks before that year and said, give me some examples, because I think sometimes we see the numbers and our eyes kind of glaze over at these figures of $260 million in Florida or $3.8 million in Timaquan Preserve. So I said, give me some examples. And one of the great ones they gave me was Little Bighorn. So I went there. The visitor center is, I think it dates back to 1966, when there was a big initiative, but it's very outdated. And when there was flooding or rain there, the basement would fill with water. And there were all these historic pieces of American history. So they basically had to save those. They had to move them. They're now in a warehouse in Tucson. So they need a new visitor center there. Things like that you know, that's how it affects you, the American public, the visitor to our national parks.
And for people who've never had the opportunity to go to Grand Canyon or Yosemite, they can visit parks right in our area. John Adornato, we've got the gorgeous Cumberland Island National Seashore in Georgia. We've got the Castillo, the fort in St. Augustine. We've got 46,000 acres of the Timaquan Ecological and Historic Preserve right in the middle of Jacksonville. You know, it's amazing to me how we have three in our area alone. And we continually realize when we talk about the parks on this show, a lot of people don't even know they're there. They might not realize they're right in our backyard, you know?
Well, that's true, and I'll throw in a couple more. Fort Caroline and Fort Matanzas are all within an easy day's activity. On the weekend, please come visit them. Gulf Islands National Seashore may be, you know, a day's drive or a weekend-long activity, but that's what more than 10 million people visited the 11 National Park Service sites in Florida in 2017 alone. And what that resulted in is over $600 million in economic benefits to the surrounding communities. So our national parks right here in Florida are economic generators. They are important to the people that live here and important to the people that we know come and visit Florida on a regular basis. So we want to make sure that that's the best experience that it can be. But unfortunately, it's not. Unfortunately, visitor centers are damaged or under repaired. Parking lots, cause problems for people's tires when they walk in, or drive in, rather. At Everglades National Park, the Park Service vehicles have to replace their tires on a more regular basis than normal, because the roads are in such disrepair. So it's not even just, oh my goodness, we should repave this road, but now we have to pay for the cost of additional tires and wear and tear on vehicles. That's not good use of the American taxpayer dollars. We need to solve these problems for the long term and for the short term.
And with all of that said, Mark Woods, as we mentioned on Friday, Congressman Rutherford will join representatives from the National Parks Conservation Association to take a tour of Timucuan. Are you planning to tag along?
Definitely. I'm looking forward to it. I'm glad they let me know about it. Because I've seen these stats before about the backlog at Timucuan, but I don't even really know what the details are. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about what things need repair in our backyard national park.
Yeah, and I've been to the Timucuan several times myself. I've been to Fort Caroline, the Rebolt Monument, the Castillo in St. Augustine. Just as a casual person walking through, I'm not aware of what the deferred maintenance issues are there. John Adornato, before we let you go, what if this money would be allocated, how would it be used locally? Do you have that information?
I sure do. Well, like I said, that in Florida alone, there's $260 million in repairs that are needed. At Timucuan, there's about $4 million worth of projects that are on that list. And they include things like garage and mechanic and maintenance areas of the facility so that we can make sure that all of the facilities are well kept. But specifically, what Timucuan offers visitors the opportunity to learn and contemplate an important and painful chapter in our history. The site tells the story of the early 19th century living where the Kingsley family cultivated cotton, sugar cane, and corn using the forced labor of approximately 60 slaves. So what's there is the plantation house, the kitchen house, and cabins of the enslaved people. All of these are in disrepair. But Timucuan tells the story of 6,000 years of human history, and so we need to make sure that these repairs are made so that we can preserve and tell and learn from that complex history that we have.
It's an important topic, and we're so glad you're both here to share it with us. Keep me posted. Thanks for joining us, John Adornato. He's with the National Parks Conservation Association. Mark Woods, columnist at the Florida Times Union, and he's the author of Lassoing the Sun, A Year in America's National Parks. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Look forward to seeing you on Friday.
In a moment, how to protect yourself from Lyme disease this summer, along with some important new research from UNF. That's after this.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member. Sign in and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. From the State House to the Everglades to the Panhandle, Florida has a unique story.
So join us every Friday for the Florida Roundup.
And hear from newsmakers, journalists, and Floridians from all across the state.
About the issues that matter to you.
The Florida Roundup, Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
Hi, I'm Miguel Sanon.
I'm Nora Jones.
My name is Pedrito Martinez.
I'm Christian McBride with Jazz Night in America. Our new show is bringing you inside the jazz world. We're headed to concerts around the country, from New York to L.A. to D.C., and we're talking directly to musicians, finding out how and why they do what they do. Join me right here for Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, more and more Americans are being infected with diseases carried by ticks and mosquitoes, federal researchers say this week. That includes Lyme disease. Now, Lyme accounted for more than 80% of all tick-borne diseases over the last decade, according to the Centers for Disease Control. May is Lyme Disease Awareness Month, and raising awareness about this often misunderstood disease is so important. Here with more, Dr. Kerry Clark of UNF. He joins us now with important research he's been conducting about Lyme disease in the Southeast. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, Dr. Shirley Hartman with Mandarin Wellness Center. She treats patients with Lyme disease. Good to see you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And it's 549-2937 to join us. Let's begin with you, Dr. Hartman. The CDC is warning people to be aware that this hot season could be a particularly bad one for these insect-borne illnesses. What advice do you have, first off, for people to protect themselves against Lyme disease?
Well, first, people need to be aware that there are problems with Lyme in the South. In one study that was published, there were 150 cases of CDC-reported Lyme in Florida, but there were 6,000 cases of canine Lyme in Florida. Part of the problem is that we're being told that it really is not a hotbed of Lyme here. So doctors and people aren't aware that they need to protect against that. And if people have problems, to have treatment. So when people are in areas where there's brush, wild areas, you know, they need to wear protection. They need to have long pants, tuck their pants into their socks, light clothing, use DEET or other kinds of protection, and check for ticks once they're out. And then it's important for people to realize that if they develop problems with what I call pain, brain, and Lyme, that can easily be Lyme, because Lyme can impact those areas. Pain being nerve pain, muscle pain, joint pain, and brain cognitive dysfunction, even degenerative neurologic disorders like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's can actually have Lyme as a source cause. And Lyme, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, collagen vascular diseases, autoimmune disorders, rheumatoid arthritis, and lupus. So when people have pain, brain, and Lyme, they should be tested
for Lyme. And often, Dr. Kerry Clark, people, particularly in this part of the country, are gaslighted by the medical profession. They're told there's no way you could have Lyme disease. Your research shows otherwise, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, we know that we have ticks in this part of the country that are capable of transmitting Lyme. That's been well documented for decades. We know that people get bitten by those ticks because they send those ticks to me to do testing on them. So I get them year round. And so we have all of the factors that are necessary to have Lyme here. And we just need greater awareness to try to get ahead of it a little bit, because what Dr. Hartman and I end up dealing with all the time are people who are very chronically ill, who've been sick for a very long time. They've been to 12 or 20 doctors already. They can't get a diagnosis. And by that time, they're incredibly complicated and difficult to deal with. We'd rather get ahead of this and start trying to prevent Lyme or treat it extremely early and prevent it from going into a persistent type of infection.
Undine tweets the show, "Thanks, Dr. Hartman. You are my awesome Lyme doctor. She's got me on the road to recovery." So a patient tweeting the show about you, Dr. Shirley Hartman. And I think, as Kerry Clark said, people often end up coming to you after they've gotten no help anywhere else and they can't figure out what's wrong with them. And then they finally get a diagnosis from someone like you, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's astounding to me that we have people that come to us for Lyme from Virginia, Kentucky, Illinois, all over the state of Florida, the Panhandle, South Florida, Georgia, Virginia. And these people will have sometimes even a CDC positive Lyme test, and they're told they don't have Lyme.
We're going to take a quick break and continue talking about Lyme Disease Awareness Month right after this.
The Florida Theater presents Ira Glass, creator and host of This American Life, live at the Florida Theater Saturday, November 10th, 8 p.m. Using audio clips, music, and video, Ira Glass delivers a unique talk sharing lessons from his life and career in storytelling. Ira Glass, live at Florida Theater. Tickets, floridatheater.com.
8 migrant children are handed over to human traffickers.
A U.S. government agency was actually responsible for delivering some of the victims into the hands of the abusers.
Now, the Department of Health and Human Services says it also lost track of 1,500 unaccompanied minors. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Most teachers in America have worked a second job to make ends meet.
When you have 15 years experience and two master's degrees and you're not making $40,000, that's an issue.
As educators walk off the job and schools close in Arizona, we'll ask what teachers really think about their working conditions. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Everyone feels lonely now and then, but are we feeling it more? Studies suggest more Americans are dealing with it, especially young people. Loneliness can affect your mental and physical health. Is this an invisible epidemic? And if so, what should we do? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Continuing our conversation about Lyme Disease Awareness Month with Dr. Shirley Hartman of the Mandarin Wellness Center. She treats a lot of Lyme patients all over this part of the country. And Dr. Carrie Clark, researcher at UNF. Dr. Clark, you've received some new grants to continue this work. Is that right?
Yes. We've been very fortunate recently to get some new funding from the Coastal Blood Foundation here in our area. They're funding a study that's looking at chronic infections that might be potentially threatening the blood supply in this area. And that ties right into the other research that we're doing on Lyme and tick-borne infections. So I've also received a recent grant from the Florida Lyme Disease Association for a new study that we're going to be doing and partnering with a company that does some incredibly complex metagenomic type testing to try to detect any type of infection whatsoever that we might be able to find in these incredibly complicated and very ill patients.
These patients come to you, Dr. Hartman, as Dr. Clark said, with a lot of complex issues. You treat them in a holistic way. It's an alternative way of treating particularly Lyme disease. And patients often come to you when they haven't had success with conventional medicine, correct?
True. The problem is that we have a standard paradigm of how bacterial infections are treated. We're used to having things like staph and strep that have a really rapid growth cycle that replicate on the order of hours. So if you take 10 days of penicillin, you're going to get through 30, 50, 100 growth cycles. Lyme has a 28-day growth cycle. So you would need a year of treatment in order to get through a dozen growth cycles. Lyme has the ability to hide. It hides inside cyst walls, it hides inside cells, it hides inside biofilm, it hides inside clot. So all of those areas in which it can hide need to be treated. When there is a biofilm present, it can require antibiotic concentrations 1,000 times higher to penetrate the biofilm. So we need to manage all of those problems. We need to treat for co-infections. Ticks are like nature's dirty needle. People get infections with Lyme, Bartonella, Ehrlichia, Mycoplasma, Q fever, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, rickettsial infections, Powassan virus, Heartland virus, microfilarial worms.
Oh my goodness.
These people are microbial
wastes. I'm afraid to
walk
outside.
So all of these things have to be managed. And because Lyme has the ability to compromise the immune system, the pituitary that's the master gland of the body, and mitochondria where we produce energy, these people have to have treatment that optimizes the functioning of their mitochondria, their endocrine system, their immune system, and their detox systems. And if you don't treat those, they don't get better because their immune system has to play a role. They're immune compromised much in the same way that people who have AIDS are immune compromised.
The Lyme Disease Challenge tweets the show, "Thanks for spreading awareness about Lyme in the South. We are facing a public health crisis that is ignored and underfunded. Children are at the greatest risk and they are literally losing their childhoods. Thanks for that." Before we let you go, Dr. Clark, I think one overriding message we need to make sure people understand is that Lyme disease is real in the South. It has always been thought of as a Northeastern disease, but it simply, your research shows, is more widespread than that.
Yes, and not only Lyme, but just a group of tick-borne infections that are playing a role in all of these people's illnesses. And I also want people to understand that, you know, everybody that has Lyme disease-like symptoms might not even have Lyme disease. They may have some other group of infections. These people still are very ill, and they need to be treated. And that's the focus of some of our newer research, is that we're taking a very open-minded approach, and we're looking for any type of infection that might be in these people, and we're trying to get information that's going to help direct specific treatment and get each individual well. And we hope that we'll uncover some patterns in some of these patients that will reveal some new directions for that research as well.
It's important research being done right here on the UNF campus. Keep us posted on it, and follow these tips this summer from the CDC. Use insect repellent if you're particularly out in the woods, wear long sleeves and long pants. Take steps to control ticks and fleas on pets and mosquitoes. Make sure that there's no standing water outside your home. Simple common sense steps like that can protect you and your family against tick and mosquito-borne illnesses. May is Lyme Disease Awareness Month. So thanks again to Dr. Carrie Clark of UNF and Dr. Shirley Hartman with Mandarin Wellness Center for raising the awareness right here on this show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you again, Melissa.
And that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And next on 1A, if you ever feel lonely, turns out you're not alone, especially young people. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. And if you're catching our rebroadcast tonight at 8 p.m., just stay tuned for music. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.